food. I'm sure that if you were to take a trip back in time to the years of my childhood, one of the starkest contrasts between the two eras would be in the area of food. This would apply to all aspects, ranging from shopping habits, food storage, the range of food available, cooking methods, and dietary preferences. Firstly, in my hometown, there were no supermarkets. The largest food shop was probably a cooperative, although the greatest range of fresh food was found in the newly rebuilt Swansea Indoor Market, opened in 1961, and before that, in the open market. Our groceries usually came from one of the two family grocers in the square, supplemented by fruit and veg from the greengrocers and meat from the butchers, both local. I believe fresh fish must have meant a trip to Swansea, unless there was a fishmonger's in Sketty. I don't remember it. Convenience food was pretty limited in my early years, and it was some years even before we had a fridge, which only had a tiny freezer compartment. Meat and perishables were kept in a perforated metal meat safe, housed in the pantry, which also had some stone shelves, probably slate, to provide some rudimentary cooling. Consequently, perishables were probably bought several times a week, as the flexibility of freezing and microwaves was an unknown technology. I recall one of my mum's recipes, which seemed exotic at the time, was a corned beef and tinned tomato pie, flavoured with a tin of mulligatawny soup, and also containing quarters of hard-boiled eggs. These must have been a good standard non-perishable ingredients. I recently tried to recreate this, and I must say, to my modern palate, it still seemed, well, exotic. More exotica was soon to arrive with the advent of Vesta packet meals. These were dehydrated savoury meals, and I recall that the range included beef curry, which contained dried beef or sultanas, paella with dried chicken chunks and dried shrimps, chow mein with crispy and soft noodles, and a sachet of soy sauce. This not only seemed exotic, but quite space age, and held out a future full of jetpacks and holidays on the moon, as we were promised in the Eagle comic. These preserved meals must have helped with the less frequent shopping trips, but I'm unaware of the pricing relative to fresh food. In any event, as soon as my brother or me spotted these exotica, either in the shopping or pantry, we were pestering to eat them, which probably wasn't very helpful. The recent pandemic has seen many of us using home delivery services to a greater extent, and the prevalence of websites, even for small local businesses, has helped with this. Home deliveries existed in the 1950s, and for our household included the daily milk delivery, newspapers, paraffin, coal deliveries, initially by horse and cart, and the lemonade Corona lorry was also popular, although this was a weekly call, and I don't think we bought it every week. The local grocer brought the order that had been dropped off as a list the same day, and random callers selling household cleaning items out of suitcases were common, as well as door-to-door encyclopedia salesmen in those pre-Wikipedia days. In those days, before phone lines became commonplace, important news was sent by telegram, with a message from vague memory being constructed by pasted printed words, like some anonymous ransom note from a mafia film. They were also delivered by uniformed telegram boys, young guys with peaked hats on small engined red motorbikes, British-made BSA Bantams, I believe, with distinctive buzzy engines. A telegram rarely contained good news and was often the first you would hear about a family death or the hospitalisation of somebody. The most unusual travelling salesmen were what is known as in South Wales as the Shawnee Onion Men. As children, we were told they'd come over from France with a bicycle laden with onions to sell here, and were distinctive, apart from the bicycle laden with onions, by wearing what we recognise as stereotypical Frenchman's costumes of a beret, work jacket and a striped shirt. See Allo Allo, the last century non-PC TV series. Now, maybe I was a suspicious child, but before I'd undertaken any studies in economics, it didn't strike me as terribly financially viable to travel here from France with a bicycle full of onions, an item not notable to even my limited knowledge of foodstuffs pricing to be a high value item. It just didn't seem to add up. Was this some fiendish French plot to infiltrate the traditional British food chain with their Gallic foodstuffs? Was it a reprisal for abandoning them in 1940 by legging it at Dunkirk? I may be onto something here, as the cost of travel to France was so high, we didn't know anyone who went there for their holidays. My dad had never suggested it. He was steering clear of the place after being evacuated at Dunkirk. Also, he hated onions, so maybe he knew more about this than he was letting on. I was never able to check out the maths, as due to my father's aversion, onions were rarely seen in our house, certainly not the long French strings of them. Subsequent research that I've kindly carried out at your behalf has uncovered the following facts, some of them contradictory. One version claims they were Breton smallholders who had band together to charter a coaster to bring their crop over the channel to dock in Swansea or Cornwall. They would spread through the area, living rough where they could, often in sheds or barns. There they would plant the onions together in strings and load as many as they could carry onto their bikes each day to start their rounds, selling in the street and door to door. They would stay for around 6 weeks away from their families, and with their Breton language being part of the Celtic family, they were welcomed in the Welsh valleys and in Cornwall. The mass journeys were described as being interrupted by wartime from 39 to 1945, and although restarting afterwards, were at much lower levels of activity. I certainly remember them in the 1950s, so I now imagine massed armies of them in previous decades, like a pungent cycling rush hour in Amsterdam or Copenhagen. The onion strings are described as being hung up in the kitchen from a ceiling hook, though my dad's dislike of vegetables ensured this didn't happen in our house. Another writing places the story with beginnings as far back as 1828, when a Breton, Henry Olivier, sailed from Roscoff to Plymouth with a cargo of onions, and after successful sales, was followed by other Breton farmers suffering poverty in post-revolution France. It's further claimed that the rapid industrialisation in Britain had led to a shortage of agricultural workers who had migrated to the mines, ironworks and factories for better paid work. As a result, the imports from France were welcomed. This made these exotic onion sellers a common sight across the land, but with the Celtic language limb making them particularly welcome in Wales. One description of the trade paints a different picture, almost like a gangmaster scenario. It was said that the investors would often meet in a bar to put up the funds to buy the onions, at the same time recruiting a company of 20 to 30 men, who would be hired for the season at an agreed and usually low wage, but being provided with rudimentary board and lodgings. The board, I suspect, was primarily onion-based. Each group was managed by a master who was responsible for finding lodgings, often in derelict buildings, and also was responsible for storing the onions, fixing the pricing, and ordering fresh supplies of onions when necessary. The onions were transported over in sacks and then strung together by plaiting their long leaves to make the onions more attractive. This seems an early artisan marketing ploy. The onions were originally carried on long sticks with notches cut in them to hold the strings. The more familiar bicycle only started to be used early in the 20th century. It was traditional for the sailings to start from Roscoff on the day after the fate of St. Barbie at the end of July, with sailing boats in earlier times often being at sea for up to a week. Apart from discomfort and presumably an overpowering aroma of onions, there was often more serious dangers. In 1905, the steamship Hilda ran aground near St. Malo on the French coast, and 74 onion sellers drowned, with only six survivors of the shipwreck, five of whom were onion men. The interwar period between 1919 and the early 1930s is thought to be the high point of the trade. Trade was interrupted by the 39 to 45 war, but although it resumed afterwards, there were other difficulties. The UK government was keen to promote homegrown produce and to reduce imports, and it introduced trade tariffs and inducements to home farmers. It's thought by 1970 the numbers coming to sell were reduced to only some 140. The work was hard, with long hours and uncomfortable living conditions, with the added problem of being away from home for several months, often housed in condemned houses and old warehouses, in a climate colder and wetter than at home. As British farmers increasingly grew their own onions, together with the rise of supermarkets, the Shawnee onion men of my childhood just became a memory, but a nice one. Despite, or perhaps because of, the lack of onions in our house, my mum cooked a number of recipes that proved very popular during my childhood. These are mostly non-savoury, or let's be more specific, cakes and puddings. I think previous generations had a sweeter tooth, although browsing down the supermarket aisles now, there still seems to be a healthy supply of non-healthy sugar-based foodstuffs. I'm not saying that manufactured ranges of cakes, biscuits, etc. didn't exist then, just that in our house, at any rate, many of the sweeter recipes were home-baked. It seems ironic when the TV schedules are full of cookery programmes and baking competitions that the sales of ready meals and takeaway sales in this country are at an all-time high. It's as if cookery has become a spectator sport. That's just my view. My mum's culinary repertoire in the 1950s included her lemon meringue pie, a labour-intensive dish that required separating egg whites and yolks, squeezing lemons and making pastry for the base. This dish, as with others, was prepared in a large ceramic mixing bowl using a hand whisk and cooked in a gas oven without a timer. It was a regular family favourite. Any baking of cakes was the opportunity to help with the washing up, preceded by scraping the residue of a cake mix or icing with a spoon as a special treat. Cakes and biscuits were cooked from scratch without mixes. Chocolate icing was made with cocoa and icing sugar and butter. Similarly, lemon icing with squeezed lemons, vanilla extract for, yes, vanilla, an extract from a small bottle, and rarer coffee icing, as coffee in my early childhood was less common at home than tea. This was made with coffee from a bottle of the improbably named Camp Coffee. A large glass bowl was used for homemade trifle. This was a layered construction with a foundation of jelly in the base, usually red strawberry, dotted with chunks of stale cake from the previous week if available, also pineapple chunks if my mum was in an extravagant mood, or maybe to offset the staler cake. This is followed by a first story of blancmange, usually bright pink in colour and not my favourite ingredient, with the roof above it made of a mixture of cold custard, sometimes with swirls of fresh cream, and dotted with hundreds and thousands of sugar sweets, the colours of which bled into the custard. I say sometimes because the shelf in the pantry where my mum kept the baking ingredients was well known to me and my brother and visiting friends, and although the sweeter ingredients were often masked by a sentry line of bags of flour, we were not deterred. Occasional pilfering of the glacé cherries and sweet toppings provided the interim sugar rush for us young dentist friends between the all too frequent visits to the local sweet shops. The secret was always to leave some in the jars or packets so as not to arouse suspicions. I was fortunate enough to have a mum who actively encouraged sweet consumption by making homemade toffee. It wasn't her fault. In those days, sugar consumption was seen as giving necessary energy to growing youngsters and adults alike. But the toffee fully embraced this idea. I believe the ingredients were sugar, of course, butter and Lyle's golden syrup, always known as treacle, and from a distinctive green and gold metal tin. On the front of the tin was a drawing of a sleeping lion surrounded by a swarm of bees with the slogan below, "Out of the strong came forth sweetness." Now at the time, I had not unreasonably concluded that the lion, well known for bravery and fearlessness, was favourably disposed towards the bees, and they were existing together, sweetly, in a harmonious relationship. My parents never dissuaded me of this truth, that this was, shock, horror, a dead lion, and the bees had nested in the corpse and were making honey there. It seemed an unlikely scenario. Maybe the bees en masse had killed the lion. What's even stranger, now I've researched it, is that the Lyle Company had registered the trademark in 1904, with the owner, an Abraham Lyle, who was a deeply religious man and was inspired by a Bible story in the book of Judges. It tells of Samson, the famous biblical strongman, travelling to the land of the Philistines in search of a wife. En route, he killed a lion. On his return journey, he saw that a swarm of bees had formed a honeycomb in the carcass. The Wikipedia entry doesn't tell us whether he found a wife and whether she was a Philistine. I can reveal that further Bible study is undertaken by me on your behalf, that indeed he did. The story doesn't end happily for Samson, or the 30 people he killed over a dispute over a riddle involving the lion and the bees, when his wife, who was a Philistine, revealed the answer. He also rejected her, and it seems the bees were the only winners in the whole story. What's the most amazing thing to me now is that this story was thought to be a sound basis for an advertising slogan for a product favoured by children. Well, it was different times. Away from the more famous Holy Bible, I managed to find a cut-out fading page of newspaper between the pages of one of my mum's Bibles, Modern Cookery Illustrated. The scrap contains a recipe that I believe was my mum's toffee recipe. It's described as two easy sweets to make. Toffee. Dissolve 1 tablespoon of treacle or syrup in a teacup of boiling water and pour over 1/2 pound of butter, cut up into a pan, with 3/4 pound of sugar. Brown is best. Boil for 15 to 20 minutes, then pour into a slightly buttered tin. Do not move until quite set. It omits to say do not let small children sample while still boiling hot, which seems something my mum had to contend with, or any reference to the 1/2 hour to be spent cleaning the tray and the saucepan in the absence of a dishwasher. Still, I loved it, and still have the majority of my own teeth. As we lived in Wales, it's not surprising that Welsh cakes were a staple item on the menu of home-baked cakes. These were made from a mixture in the white and yellow dimple mixing bowl, with a mixture sometimes enlivened by the addition of currants or sultanas. The Welsh cakes themselves were cooked as a kind of drop scone on an iron hot plate heated on top of the gas ring, where they would be quickly baked on both sides. They were usually served with a sprinkling of caster sugar. I always thought that the insides had a flavour similar to the uncooked cake mix scrapings that I was allowed during helping sessions of baking. This was likely, as the Welsh cakes were probably not entirely baked within before they were removed from the hot iron. Another local delicacy enjoyed less frequently and with mixed enthusiasm is lava bread, harvested from seaweed and sold in Swansea Market. Difficult to accurately describe, it looks rather unappetisingly like a cross between boiled spinach and a cow pat. Happily, it tastes more like spinach, with a salty infusion of the sea. I think it's the slightly slimy texture that puts people off, but it is cited as a superfood high in iron. One recommendation is to fry it with a mixture of oatmeal and serve it with your fried breakfast. Another rather alarming discovery amongst my mum's cookbooks was one that belonged to her mother and was described on the cover as for use with a New World Regulo Controlled Gas Cooker, but titled Radiation Cookery Book. Now, I suppose, strictly speaking, heating is a form of radiation, and cookery at its most elementary level is merely heating food, but really, not an encouraging title. But then the date inside was 1932, so I suppose the atomic bomb was still to come. As well as the cakes and sweet dishes, my mum did have homemade savoury recipes, admittedly of varying popularity to my palate. One was a local example of a quiche recipe that my mum called egg and bacon tart. It wasn't enlivened by onions or garlic in our house, and I always thought the bacon too rubbery, but was too polite to say so. There were various pies, steak and kidney, as well as liver and bacon, being two that I remember, but also a similar recipe with flakes of fish instead of meat. I was always more circumspect about this, as I occasionally had found a fish bone. Pies topped with mashed potato, cottage pie, I guess, were also popular, with sometimes homemade mincemeat using a kitchen mincer clamped to the kitchen work surface to eke out leftover Sunday roasts. Sausage rolls with flaky pastry and sausage meat was another popular dish, as were homemade cheese straws. Sausages were also deployed in the dish toad in the hole, hardly an appetising label for a pleasant sausage dish baked in a Yorkshire pudding mix. Chicken was a rarity in those days before cheap factory birds, and I'm not sure I had ever tasted turkey in my childhood, as I think we had chicken at Christmas, but I might have been mistaken. The other ingredient that seemed much more prevalent then were jams, chutneys and pickles. Tin fruit was enhanced by carnation and evaporated milk, sweet and creamy out of a tin. Fussell's condensed milk was another tinned addition, and this was much sweeter and thicker, although an open tin did not last long if it was in the fridge, as a sticky spoonful was very tempting.